Motto, shoot and scoot. We trained to use vehicles as both weapons and means of escape. We drove and maneuvered at high speeds. We breached roadblocks that sometimes required bashing through fixed barriers or other vehicles. A car could take an enormous amount of abuse and keep running. We combined driving and firearm tactics, using our vehicles as cover. The wheels and engine blocks afforded the best protection against high-velocity rounds. We entered and exited our cars while drawing and firing weapons. We practiced with a variety of firearms, including foreign models, particularly the AK-47 and SKS carbine. Our teams in Afghanistan carried the AK-47 because of the local availability of ammunition and the local profile. Any man toting and firing a U.S.-manufactured M4 would be immediately identified as non-indigenous. Our cover was non-existent for the locals, but we did not want to flaunt our presence or easily identify ourselves to the enemy by carrying a unique firearm. Of course, we also trained with our preferred concealed sidearms. The rare times in my agency career that I had carried a pistol, it was a Browning high-power 9mm, or my own Browning 380, which was more compact and easily tucked under a jacket or vest. During this course, I tried several new pistols and selected the Glock 9mm made in Austria out of mostly composite material. There was very little metal except for the barrel. In 5 days, I fired 2,000 rounds with no misfire and no jamming. I could drive and shoot with skill and confidence. Not surprising, because I had been doing both since I was a youngster. I could read a map with uncommon ease. My other skills were rudimentary, so I always carried plenty of black duct tape. It could fix almost anything, a ripped jacket, a leaking radiator hose, or a bleeding appendage. The refresher course served its purpose, but I remained perplexed by the training environment, a piney woods in the eastern United States. Why couldn't we train in the high desert of the Rocky Mountains, somewhere that looked and felt like Afghanistan? This unrealistic sight made little sense, except perhaps as a matter of convenience or budget. I told Kofor. He agreed that the training site was inappropriate. Then he told me to quit whining. In late August, Pavitt scrapped the mission. In response to a recent technical inspection that questioned the reliability of Afghanistan's Northern Alliance Mi-17 helicopters, he decided the risk was too high. He was correct. The old and battered helicopters were flying death traps. It was a wonder Rich and his team and those that followed had not crashed. But we had taken whatever transport we could get at the time. Now I sought other options. I countered that we could use our own airframes instead of relying on the Northern Alliance. No, we did not want to show a U.S. hand, Pavitt responded. I then argued for overland infiltration. It was summer and the high mountain passes would be open for several more weeks. I explained that non-government organizations, NGOs, like Doctors Without Borders, used the dirt track that ran from Tajikistan into the Panjshir. With a topographic map, I outlined how we could infiltrate. I noted the risks to U.S. interests and our responsibility to protect our nation. I stressed that our Afghan colleagues expected us, and we needed to keep our word. My arguments were useless. No go. In my argument, I stumbled near the edge of insubordination, but regained my balance and saluted. In our private deliberations, however, Kofor, Rich, Greg, and I wondered how unarmed aid workers grew bigger balls than the CIA. The inability to travel to Afghanistan was unacceptable, and I eventually convinced Kofor to buy an Mi-17 helicopter. With our own airframe, one that we maintained and controlled, we would have the means and flexibility to carry out our missions. It was much harder convincing our seventh floor, but we prevailed. Buying the Mi-17 was not difficult, but the cover and logistics arrangements, followed by the delivery of the helicopter to the theater, took several months. When AQ attacked our homeland in September 2001, our MI-17 was ready. We painted a new tail number on it, 9-11. It would transport our first Jawbreaker team into Afghanistan. USS Cole. 2 months after the DDO canceled our trip to Afghanistan, AQ attacked and almost sank the USS Cole in Aden Harbor, Yemen. It was 12 October 2000. On that bright day in calm waters, two AQ operatives piloted a skiff with an outboard motor toward their target. The terrorists stood at attention as their craft, packed with explosives, detonated against the hull of the destroyer. They struck almost dead center, opening a gash 40 feet long, just inches above the waterline. The blast and fragmentation killed 17 sailors and wounded 39. I walked into Kofor's office as soon as I heard about the attack. "I'm taking a team to Yemen," I stated. "Okay, take whoever you need," he answered. At CTC, we assembled a small response team of CIA specialists, including a Navy SEAL on loan to the CIA. In addition to other duties, he would serve as my capable bodyguard. The team included a couple of Arabic-speaking case officers. One was an ethnic Arab who had superb interpersonal skills. The other was a brilliant officer with several tours who had learned Arabic in less than a year. Years later, he would rise through the ranks to become the second in command of the clandestine service. Our team also included a couple of technical officers who specialized in crisis response. Kofor told me that John O'Neill would lead a large FBI contingent. The U.S. District Attorney in the New York Southern District would send a prosecutor. CENTCOM tagged General Gary Harrell to deploy. He had commanded the Delta Unit in Somalia during the 1993 intervention. The U.S. Embassy was in Sana'a. There was no consulate or any other U.S. government facility in Aden, a rough port town on the southern tip of the Saudi Peninsula that extends into the Gulf of Aden. The Department of State quickly established a command center in a local hotel. The U.S. ambassador in Sana'a was Barbara Bodine, a veteran diplomat. We all arrived in Sana'a about the same time and occupied a couple of hotel floors. With each U.S. agency pursuing its own agenda and a mix of hard-headed leaders thrown together, confusion reigned. Moreover, some Yemeni authorities seemed more concerned about the 100 armed FBI investigators in their country than they were about AQ. I instructed our technicians to sweep the hotel and the other facility housing the FBI's small army. It did not take them long. The Yemenis had bugged the FBI's quarters. I informed O'Neill, who was alternately embarrassed and furious. I told him to relax, noting that the FBI would have done the same thing or worse to an armed Yemeni contingent in New York. Ambassador Bodine and O'Neill then launched into a nasty political battle about operational authorities. I explained to O'Neill that this was not New York, and he could not act as if it was. The U.S. ambassador served as the president's representative, and she could throw us all out of the country. Eventually, the spat erupted in public, and the press loved it. Ambassador Bodine eventually restricted the FBI's role in Yemen. Despite this lousy political environment, the operational teams quickly coalesced. Working 24 hours a day, the investigation moved forward. The Yemenis provided us some critical information, because several responsible officials understood that to do so was in their country's best interests. They did not want AQ on their soil. Others were more ambivalent, and it required quiet consultations and the right mix of benefits and threats. Our native Arabic speakers, including an FBI special agent, managed the relationship with patient effectiveness. We accumulated travel records, immigration files, and eyewitness accounts. We started identifying perpetrators and linking them to Afghanistan. In a survey of the area, We found the observation post where AQ had videotaped the attack. We inspected the site. It was a half-finished multi-story house made of crude concrete blocks with protruding rebar. The enemy had slept and eaten there, on the top level. Trash was strewn along the floor. They had pissed in one corner of the unfinished house. I could still smell the urine. From the roof, with an unobstructed view over the harbor, the enemy had watched as their comrades murdered our sailors. A couple of days later, I stood with Captain Kirk Lippold on the lower deck of his ship. We gazed out the jagged hole at the ship's waterline, across the beautiful blue water. Captain Lippold explained how his crew had responded heroically, saving and treating the wounded and removing the bodies. His crew had prevented the ship from sinking, but only barely. They had stabilized the ship structurally. They had washed away the blood and gore that had splattered.